It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strangechamps.
Yeah, Huntress calling in reference to the hijacked aircraft.
This week marks the 20th anniversary of 9/11.
It's American 11.
Number of souls on board, do you know that?
I don't know. Hold on.
And if, like me, you are of a certain age, you remember where you were and what you were doing when you heard those first reports.
Anybody know what that smoke is in lower Manhattan?
Saw those first unforgettable images.
Lieutenant Tower reports that there was a fire at the World Trade Center. And that's the area where we lost the airplane.
I lived not far from it. I could see it from my window.
This is James Noctway, the celebrated war photographer.
When I saw the first tower smoking, I thought it was an accident. But an accident of that magnitude at the World Trade Center was obviously going to be very important, so I began to assemble my camera gear. While I was doing that, there was a kind of vibration in the air and my windows rattled, and I looked out my window again, saw that the second tower was burning, and understood immediately that we'd been attacked and the United States was now at war.
And just confirmed that was an airline that crashed into the World Trade Center.
There's been at least one hijack this morning and possibly two.
I got there before either of the towers fell, and I was framing both towers burning, and there's a cross. It's a cross of a church that was about a block and a half away from the South Tower. I understood that this was an attack by Al-Qaeda. I knew enough about our contemporary history. I'd worked enough in Afghanistan to feel that that was no doubt the case. And I just saw that the cross is, you know, a symbol of our culture. So I framed it that way. It wasn't, you know, wasn't such a brilliant thing to do, but it seemed obvious to me. And as I was photographing, the tower collapsed. And it was hard to believe. I was seeing it with my own eyes. Those steel girders that you see flying through the air like matchsticks are huge. I don't know how many hundreds, if not thousands of pounds each. Gigantic pieces of metal and sides of the building were flying through the air, as well as a kind of confetti of tens of thousands of pieces of paper that had been inside filing cabinets. And all of this was just floating towards me so slowly, I thought I had all the time in the world to make the frame. And I was shooting film. There were 36 frames on a roll of film as opposed to digital, which has many more. I got to the last frame when I shot that picture, and that stopped me because I knew I had to change film. And in stopping me, everything went back into normal motion, and I realized I was about to get taken out. And I had a few seconds to take cover in the lee of buildings on the other side of the street from where I was standing, and all of the wreckage sort of fell over me.
September 11th, 2001. A new type of war. That's what it is.
For more than 30 years, James Naktwe risked his life covering war zones all over the world. He's survived shooting and grenade attacks. He's won pretty much every photojournalism award there is. He's even been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize 10 times. So we talked back in 2015 when there was a new museum exhibition documenting his work in Afghanistan, Iraq, and the place it all began, Ground Zero. The photo that haunts me is the one of the firefighters at Ground Zero. All you see is rubble, huge building, and a firefighter kind of in silhouette. And there's no obvious carnage. There are no close-up faces to carry emotion, but it's unforgettable. What makes it such a powerful photograph, do you think?
The scale. The scale of that fireman against the amount of wreckage was staggering. Everyone who was on the scene was in a kind of autopilot because it was so shocking. I think everyone just did what they knew how to do. I mean, bringing out fire hoses was of no value whatsoever, but that's what firemen do, so that's what they did. As a photographer, I could have been paralyzed with disbelief, but my job is to document visually, and that's what I did. But it's still hard to believe. I looked at the picture yesterday, and it was hard to believe. I've actually never gotten over it.
I've read some of the things you said about why you chose to become a photojournalist in the first place. I think it goes way back to you were a student in the 1960s. Vietnam War was happening, civil rights protests. The photographs taken at the time, you felt really changed history.
Photographers were telling us one thing and our political and military leaders were telling us something else. And I found the work of the photographers to be more convincing. And when I finally decided what I wanted to do with my life, that's what I decided I wanted to do. I wanted to be part of that tradition. I saw that pictures could not only record history, in some way they help change the course of history. They become an element in the process of change.
So the role of the war photographer is a crucial one to a democracy, I guess.
I think it's absolutely necessary. I think that the stories we tell are vital for society to function properly. How can citizens make proper decisions unless they know what's going on? Journalism is vital, and I think the particular role that photography plays is that it can make a human connection, help people see something that is universal, that transcends culture, that transcends nationality, religion, race, and is just simply human. You're witnessing something that's happening to an individual.
It's funny, you know, the stereotype of the war photographer is the adrenaline junkie. Sounds like that's not at all what it's about for you.
Adrenaline is a fact, but it's not a reason. You know, there probably are some what you would call war junkies out there, but I don't think they're the ones who continue for very long, and perhaps they're not the ones who make the most meaningful pictures. I think, you know, it's part of it, but there's this much more deep reason for pursuing this profession than adrenaline.
How do you deal with being in the places you've been, seeing the kind of suffering you've seen? I imagine one way of dealing with it would be to wall it off when you're working, to just suppress your own reactions until later. But I'm wondering whether that's changed a bit for you over the years. I mean, whether you found ways to either to open up a bit more, to actually work with and use your emotions, or do they just get in the way?
No, the emotions are natural. You have to channel them. You have to use them. You have to channel them into the work. If I were to see things and not feel emotions, then I wouldn't make pictures that were worth much. I'm the one who has to feel it first if I'm going to make anyone else feel something. So it's never been the case. It's simply not the case that photographers go someplace and wall themselves off. Our job is actually quite the opposite. Our job is to go someplace and open ourselves up and leave ourselves vulnerable and feel those things and put it into our work so that we can translate it and pass it on to the viewers.
Hmm. You're making me think about another photo in this exhibition. It's one of an Afghan woman, I think. She's completely covered in a burqa, and she's kneeling on the ground in a graveyard. You can't even see her face, but the grief is just palpable. Where was that taken? Who is she?
It was taken in a cemetery in Kabul in 1996, and she was there mourning her brother who'd been killed in a Taliban rocket attack. At that time, the Taliban had surrounded Kabul and were shelling and rocketing daily. I think the graveyard itself is expressive. It's so humble, bare, cracked earth with uncarved, kind of raw stone. And her hand, her aged, weathered hand that had seen a hard life, reaching out, touching the stone, as if that's as close as she could get to her brother. What you don't get from the picture is the sound she was making as she was grieving for her brother. She was singing a kind of song in this very grief-stricken voice. It was very moving.
I'm just thinking about how hard it must be for you to be there to feel that much grief and then multiply that over and over again. You've taken photos of injured children and vets who are returning and painfully rehabbing themselves. People, at the moment, they're being shot or about to be shot. I don't know. What do you do with the grief?
You carry it with you. Nothing is forgotten. And I guess you have to carry it with you with as much grace as you possibly can. You know, again, as opposed to the stereotype, rather than getting hardened to it, I find that I get more and more sensitized to it, and it gets actually more difficult to witness such things, not less difficult. And it's just something you have to bear.
Do you still believe in the goodness of humans?
Oh, absolutely. I've seen so much goodness come out of the most horrible situation, so much generosity and hospitality. You know, I can't help but be moved and humbled by it. There's a very large installation. It's about 32 feet long. It's one single file, one single print, and it's a composite of 60 images that were all made in combat field hospitals during the war in Iraq. And it's pictures that show lives being saved. It's called The Sacrifice.
You've been there yourself, right? You've been shot. Weren't you injured in a grenade attack?
I'd been covering a single platoon for Time magazine, and I was with Mike Weisskopf, a Time reporter, and a grenade was thrown into the Humvee, and Mike had his hand blown off, and I got injured with shrapnel, and a couple of the soldiers got pretty badly hurt. So I was taken to that very same medical facility and medevaced out to Germany.
Were you still taking photographs while you were injured?
Until I passed out, yes.
Wow. Why do you keep going back?
I have a lot of experience. I still see that there's a reason as much as ever to do it. And I guess I do it because I can.
James Noctway is a celebrated war photographer and Peace Prize winner. And we were talking back in 2015, shortly after the Witness to History exhibition opened at New Hampshire's Courier Museum. And if you want to see some of the photos we were talking about, visit our website at ttbook.org. You know, the photojournalists who document war can have a huge impact on how people back home think about it. There have been times when a single haunting photograph really shifted public opinion about a war. For my generation, it was the 1972 image from Vietnam called Napalm Girl. the one of a naked 9-year-old girl running toward the camera, screaming. Here's the thing, though. An image of something horrible can also be beautiful, which is complicated. In 2015, writer David Shields analyzed more than a decade's worth of front-page war photographs from the New York Times, and he concluded that more often than not, the Times editors chose images that glamorized conflict. Here's Charles Monroe Kane's conversation with David Shields about his book, War is Beautiful.
I want to use the word you used because I found that to be very powerful. And the word you used is beautiful. War is Beautiful is the title of your book. Talk about provocative.
Right.
And these photos, you know, I was like, okay, I get your argument, blah, blah, blah. I got your book. Oh, my God. They are beautiful. They're really
Thanks.
Beautiful. Yeah, they could be hanging in a museum. What's wrong with that? What are you getting at with that?
For 20 years, from the first Gulf War until through 2013, I would be struck by at least a couple times a week and sometimes several times a week, I'd be struck by pictures of war that sort of fed my war porn addiction. You know, it was really, these pictures were surpassingly beautiful. They were basically war as, what would you call them, kind of 20th century modernist masterpieces. Picture after picture, photo after photo seemed to me to be virtually appropriating Jackson Pollock, Mark Rothko, Jasper Johns, Richard Diebenkorn. I mean, it was just stunning to me how much of the war had been abstracted away from any kind of raw, naked, visceral horror and sort of uploaded into a realm of very abstract horror. The opening line of the book is an epigraph from Edmund Burke, who says that horror is very beautiful when kept at a severe distance. And it seems to me that these pictures function to disseminate a certain kind of ideology subtextually, namely that we sort of tell ourselves as readers of the paper that we're informed and somehow semi-concerned citizens and that we have properly bleeding hearts. But in reality, these pictures keep the war at, you might say, psychic arm's length.
I was struck by two things. One, that they really weren't as graphic as I thought they were going to be. And two, that they're still very powerful. What do you want? Do you want more carnage? What do you want us to see?
You know, General Sherman said war is hell. And these pictures portray war as a sort of very pretty heck. First of all, I want us as citizen readers to bring enormously needed skepticism to the cultural work that these pictures do. And then I want us to depend far less on institutions that work hand in glove with the U.S. government. And third, you know, struggle more with its happy willingness to print pictures that just swoon in a kind of corporate folk art.
I hear what you're saying, but I can imagine someone saying, you know, man, they're only photographs. What's the harm?
On the one hand, you could say, what's the problem? So what? You know, the Times runs 365 pictures every year, and here's a picture. But I looked at literally 9,000 front pages of the New York Times through microfilm and microfiche from 1991 through 2013, and we found 1,000 color war photos. Color pics started in October 97. We found 1,000 color war photos, and of those 1,700 fulfilled my criterion of pictures that, in my view, aestheticized horror. And I found precious few examples that, to me, in my view, conveyed the raw horror. So you could say, what's the harm? But I guess the book is trying to argue, what subcurrent is running underneath that picture? Is there an irreducible glamour? Where is the horror? Where is the cost?
Is that policy or is this happening kind of on accident?
I think that's the $64,000 question. I mean, this book is not an investigative book in the sense that I've uncovered 47 internal memos at the New York Times in which Dick Cheney and John Kerry have sent memos to the New York Times, and they said, if you ever print a picture of a dead soldier, that you will be denied access to the higher levels of government. You know, I don't have any such proverbial smoking gun. And I think it's an open question as to what's happening. Have all these photographers simply gone to school on the Western pictorial tradition and they can't help but take pictures of war as romance, as glamour, as beauty, as glory? Have the photo editors gone to school on the same tropes? To what degree does the New York Times instantiate its own authority by having access to the U.S. government? To what degree does that access depend on the Times, in my view, pseudo-covering the war? You know, Lyndon Johnson said during the Vietnam War, I can't win this war without the support of the New York Times. And then I follow up by saying, a New York Times picture is worth 1,000 mirrors.
There's a lot of images from those wars that we've seen, just still images. Have they seduced us?
To me, these pictures are effective seduction, because if these pictures appeared on the front page of the Wall Street Journal or USA Today or the New York Daily News, there's no story because people understand those papers to be rightward-leaning, military-leaning, Fox News-esque, Murdoch-esque papers whose agenda is quite clear. But the Times' brand is weirdly a kind of quasi-neutrality. And I think seduction is particularly problematic when we don't know the agenda of the seducer. And I even feel somewhat complicit. I wish I had gotten this book done 10 years earlier. But I felt seduced for too long. And this book is an attempt to break that seduction.
David Shields is the author of War is Beautiful, the New York Times pictorial guide to the glamour of armed conflict. Charles Monroe Kane talked with him. And if you want to see some of those photos they were talking about, visit our website at ttbook.org. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Like a lot of people, I have complicated feelings about America's withdrawal from Afghanistan. For me, it kind of boils down to one question. Did we do more harm or more good by being there? And that's why I'm really interested in the Canadian historian Margaret Macmillan, who's just published a sweeping book that covers the entire human history of war and asks an even bigger question. Does war bring out the bestial side of human nature or the best? Her book is called War: How Conflict Shaped Us. And a couple of her takeaways. War is a uniquely human occupation, and it's not only or not solely destructive. uncomfortable as it is to admit, war has also galvanized social and political improvements and sparked scientific advancements. Steve Paulson dug a little deeper.
So do you think human beings are inherently violent?
This is a huge debate, and I think I come down the side that we're not inherently violent, that we may have violent tendencies. I mean, evolution has left us with a certain collection of tendencies and reactions, and when we're afraid, we do have a tendency to lash out, a tendency to use violence on others. But I don't think that means that we are necessarily violent. Often we see examples of altruism and peoples living together in the past. I think what is more important in why people fight, and I'm thinking of war, not just random one-on-one fighting, why people fight in wars is organization, ideas, cultural values. The more organized we are, unfortunately, the better we seem to get at fighting. And war is actually very organized. It's not the sort of brawl that you might get outside a bar or the random violence you might get when someone feels frightened.
So if war is a tendency that we have, maybe not that we all just want to go out and be warlike, but it's something within our DNA. What does that reveal about what it means to be human?
Well, I'm not sure it is in our DNA. I think our propensity for violence may be in our DNA, but when you think of war, it is purposive and it's often calculating. People don't just rush helter-skelter into war. They think about it, they plan for it, they train for it. And it takes often a great deal of effort, the military know this, and a great deal of training to turn people who may not want to kill others and may not want to risk their lives into those who will fight. And I suspect, and this is just a suspicion, that once we settled down and became agriculturalists, then it was harder to pick up and move away. If you're nomadic, you can pick up and move into unoccupied space and get away from those who threaten you. But once you've settled down, it's much harder to move because you have something to defend. And of course, you have much more that someone else might want to take.
And this is an age-old debate, of course. I mean, isn't this what Rousseau and Thomas Hobbes argued about a few centuries ago? Rousseau being the person who's saying, oh, we're sort of naturally peaceful, and Hobbes says, no, we're not.
Yeah, and Rousseau said really the trouble with us came when we began to get organized, and that social organization has led us into becoming more confrontational with each other. Whereas Hobbes said, if you were to go back to the ancient world, the primitive world, you would find it very nasty indeed because there would be no central government and no way of controlling the impulses of people to fight with each other. I mean, what Hobbes saw as actually a good thing was the development of a big state, the Leviathan, which had a monopoly of force, which could therefore maintain order in its own territories and defend its people against those who would try and take it over or destroy it.
Do you think Hobbes was right?
I think Hobbes was right in some ways, but I think where I think he was wrong, I do share his pessimistic view, but where I think he was wrong is that he thought that it would be impossible ever to have international society, that the international order would always be anarchic and always be sort of dog against dog or cat against cat. And I think that was too pessimistic a view. I think we have been thinking for a long time about how we build international institutions and how we build international norms and ways of treating each other, which will obviate, get rid of the need for war. Who would have predicted 100 years ago that the former enemies of, say, Britain, France, and Germany would be living together and cooperating with each other? It would have seemed an impossible dream. And so I think we have to bear in mind that it is possible to move beyond war as a way of settling differences among nations. You know, we can use other means. We can use courts. We can use arbitration. We can use sanctions. International law, which has become very important. The possibility is there, but what we also have at the same time is the possibility for war.
Now, there is another historical counterexample, perhaps, in terms of, you know, if we want to contrast human beings with another species, and that's our ancient cousins, the Neanderthals, who were as big as the humans of the time, maybe bigger, but they did not seem to be as well organized socially, probably didn't live in as big groups. And of course, there's been this long-running debate or question about why did the Neanderthals go extinct? Why did we survive? And it maybe plays into what you're saying is that ancient humans were better organized and therefore more warlike and perhaps wiped out the Neanderthals.
Yeah. Well, it's a possibility, isn't it? I mean, the better organized you are horribly in a way, the better you are at making war. Because when you think of what it takes to develop warriors, and it does take training, and you then have to get them the weapons, you have to provide the weapons, you have to feed them, you have to make sure they get in the right order to the right place at the right time. And of course, with modern war, it gets more and more complicated when you think of the huge logistical support that is needed for modern war. It is, I think, a question of organization. Big wars, long wars, deadly wars wouldn't be possible without tremendous organization.
So it actually does suggest that there are evolutionary advantages to being warlike, that the groups willing to wage war against other people have prospered.
Well, they have often prospered up to a point. And you could argue, as Hobbes has argued, and in fact others, Charles Tilly, I think, has argued very persuasively, that war has helped to create bigger states, which can, in fact, benefit those who live within their borders because they provide more stability and security. In the Roman Empire was built through war and partly maintained through war, but those who lived inside the Roman Empire enjoyed a higher standard of living, could travel freely because the roads were safe and the seas were safe. Trade could move through all the Roman territories, again, because of the security it offered. And I think it's very striking that people wanted to move into the Roman Empire and not out. And I think that's because life was better inside that big organization. Somewhere behind it lay the threat of force. And of course, the Roman borders were maintained by soldiers. But you could argue that building up bigger political units, even in brutal ways, and even if they're not particularly nice to their own citizens, is probably creating a better environment for living in than living in a state of anarchy with sort of constant low-level wars and raids going on.
Now, there is a counter-argument that has surfaced in recent years, most notably from Steven Pinker, who has argued that human beings are getting less violent, especially since the Enlightenment. What do you make of his argument?
Well, it's a very interesting argument, and of course he makes it with great research, great evidence, and great subtlety. Many societies are getting less violent. We tolerate public violence much less. We no longer have prize fights where people batter each other to death. We no longer have people matched against animals. We no longer have public executions. And in most developed societies, and many less developed societies, the homicide rates are way down. Your own country, the United States, is something of an outlier there. But generally, I think his argument that we are becoming more peaceful in the ways in which we deal with each other in domestic societies is right. But I don't think that's war. And I think war is something different. There's a very interesting counter-argument by Charles Wrangham called The Goodness Paradox, which
Oh, you mean Richard Wrangham.
Last year. Oh, sorry, Richard Wrangham. Yes, sorry. The Goodness Paradox, in which he argues that we have, in fact, probably become nicer and less violent as individuals. And he has this very interesting argument that, in a sense, we may have domesticated ourselves by our choice of mates and by breeding out or simply not reproducing those who are most violent among us, or actually perhaps killing those who are most violent among us, rather than in the way in which wolves have been domesticated into nice, friendly dogs who sit on your lap. And what he's argued, however, in the process of domestication, we may have become nicer as individuals, but we've also become better at organizing, and we've become better at using purposive violence. That the paradox he points to is that we may have got better at making war, even as we've become rather nicer people.
Fascinating.
It really is.
Yeah. Can we generalize about how most wars actually get started?
Well, I tried to. I mean, there are many reasons. You get all sorts of reasons. Someone insults someone, someone marries someone, someone mistake happened. But I think if you look at it, and I may be wrong, but I tend to see it as greed. You have something that someone else wants. Maybe that's territory, maybe that's silver or gold or whatever. And on the other side of that is fear, that you may go to war out of fear that someone's about to attack you, or you may go to war because you feel you have no choice but to go to war because you fear for your very survival. And then the final category is, I haven't got the right term for it, but I called it ideas and ideologies. It's the things we think and believe in that can lead us to make war. And religion, of course, can do that. If you want to build a paradise on earth, or if you want to achieve your salvation in eternity, you may go to war because death will have less peril for you. You'll feel less frightened of death, and you feel you're part of a much greater cause. And nationalism can be the same sort of thing. You will fight for a nation and die for a nation, perhaps, because you feel you're fighting for something bigger than yourself. Or you will fight, as many peoples have done, and including, of course, in the United States, you'll fight in a civil war, because you have different views within the same society of what that society should be and who should control that society.
And those tend to be the bloodiest wars, right? The civil wars.
I think they tend to be the worst. Civil wars and the wars of ideologies, whether it's building socialism on Earth or paradise in the afterlife, because you believe you're doing something for the greater good of humanity in the longer run. And so anyone who opposes you really should be almost, it's almost a moral imperative to eliminate those people because they are standing in the way of a greater project. And so you should feel no compunction in removing them from the face of the earth. In a civil war, you're not just fighting those soldiers out in the field or the sailors out on the seas. You're fighting the whole society because it is wrong. And so even the children are wrong. Even the old people are wrong. There's no one innocent in such wars. At least that's the belief.
Now, we've been talking about the horror of war, but there is another side to it, which you go into at some length in your book, and that actually a lot of good things come out of war. Scientific advancement, sometimes more social equality. Societies can get restructured. How far would you take that argument?
Well, I'm always cautious with it because I get people getting quite cross, as they should, but I think they misunderstand me saying that war is a good thing for us, and I don't think that at all. But I think it is noticeable in history that it sometimes takes a very great challenge and great crisis to get us collectively to do things that we wouldn't think of doing in normal times because they're too expensive or too difficult or too disruptive. And a war is one of those challenges which brings out those responses. So too is a pandemic. I've been reflecting very much on the current pandemic, where you see governments which had been talking about austerity and getting rid of deficits and balancing the books, suddenly spending money with a free hand because it is necessary. Huge amounts of money have been invested in trying to find vaccines and treatments for the COVID-19. And I think war can do that as well. It simply makes possible things which aren't possible in peacetime.
Can you give a few examples of that?
Yeah, sure. Medicine. A great many medical advances have come about as a result of war. They might have come about anyway, but we'll never know. New drugs have been developed in war. Penicillin, for example, which was discovered in the interwar years of the 1920s, was considered too expensive to produce. And then the Second World War came along, and suddenly it's not too expensive when you want to keep those who are fighting for you alive. And society as a whole has benefited enormously from penicillin.
So if violence is part of human nature and we seem to have this propensity to start wars, I guess I'm wondering, can we ever overcome these inherent urges within us, or will we always be warring animals?
No, I think we can overcome them, and societies change. I mean, I'm so struck by the way in which Germany has changed. Germany was a society that in the 19th century, when it was first made a country, and in the 20th century, was imbued, or at least parts of German society were imbued with militaristic values and an admiration for the military in a sense, which the military shared, that the military were the noblest and best part of the nation. And that's completely gone. I mean, Germany is a different society in a different country. I mean, I think what's happened in Europe is very, very significant. Most European countries have moved well away from military values and have moved away from thinking that war is a useful tool of state. It is now, I think, unthinkable that any European country will go to war with another European country. It doesn't achieve anything. So I do think it's absolutely possible and indeed very hopeful that we can move into societies and ways of thinking which don't see war as something that should ever be used.
Historian Margaret McMillan talking about her book, War: How Conflict Shaped Us. You can find a link to Steve's full interview with her in Nautilus magazine. Just go to our website at ttbook.org. So if humans are getting better and better at waging war, how are we doing at waging peace? Next up, the remarkable story of Liberian peace activist and Nobel Prize winner Lima Bowie. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. It's tempting to think that war is inevitable, that human beings are just too violent, too aggressive to maintain any kind of lasting peace. Does it really have to be that way?
Liberia had gone from bad to worse to ridiculous.
Liberian peace activist Lima Bowie.
People were inventing new ways of killing people. Pregnant women were being degutted. People were using plastic bags to drop in people's eyes and melting hot objects over people's bodies. So it was a terrible time. There was no regard for women or their place in society or their lives. It was just easy to humiliate, rape, and to oppress them. There is something about being pushed to the wall. You have two options, to either give in or fight back. The one thing that I can say was that we knew we would die. But the question was, do you want to die without even trying, or do you want to die? Then let the history be that you die trying. We didn't think that we would bring peace, but we knew that we would give the world another side of the conflict. So when we stepped out, it was about changing the narrative about war.
Back in 2003, the civil war in Liberia had been going on seemingly forever. There were unspeakable atrocities on both sides. And then Lima Bowie basically stood up and said, enough. She gathered the women of Liberia together in a nonviolent protest, and it ended the civil war. Not only did her efforts lead to the ouster and imprisonment of the dictator Charles Taylor, she also won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2011. Steve Paulson wanted to know why, when things looked so hopeless, Lima thought she could make a difference.
There were so many things that you were up against, and one of them was that Charles Taylor had prohibited any public gatherings of protesters, but you and these other Christian and Muslim women in your movement gathered every day, and there were thousands of you demanding peace, demanding an audience with Taylor. Why didn't he arrest you, or why didn't he have you killed?
Well, that is the question that many people still ask still today, but I say one thing. What I've come to learn is that when you have brutal dictators and violent people, they have no response for nonviolence. So it totally took him off guard. It would have been easy for us to come out and throw rocks, and then he would have a reason for killing us. But how do you kill a group of people who sit there with a banner that says, we want peace now?
So incredibly dangerous, obviously. I mean, you said earlier that you assumed you would die during this protest. How scared were you?
There wasn't a lot of fear. In the initial stage when we started, yes, there were moments where I got afraid. But every day as we stepped out to protest, and every day as I got to know the women we were protesting with and know their stories, every day that confidence grew, the courage grew, and a lot of things. But there was very little fear by the time we entered the second week of protesting, let alone by the second year.
When did you think that you might actually have a chance to bring down Charles Taylor, to remove him from power?
When he agreed to meet us, because he had resisted and said no. When he agreed to meet us, something profound happened that day. We got to the executive mansion and the soldiers said they had been instructed that if we were less than 25, we should not be allowed into his mansion. And then I asked, what if we're more than 25? And then they laughed, because at that time, there was so much fear around this figure, Taylor, that no one expected that more than 25 women would show up to protest him. And I said, what if we're more than 25? And they said, then you can come in. At that moment, we sent message up to where the women had lined up over 2,500 of us and said, calm down. And the soldiers saw that sea of white and they were like, wow, these women are really serious.
It's an astonishing story. And partly what you're saying is that he and pretty much everyone else in Liberia was just assuming that you would be terrified to go in and meet with him. Somehow you managed to turn that around. I mean, you seemed to get through that terror.
That day when we went to see Taylor, for me standing up to speak to him, I just told myself, because they had given me a statement to read. By the time I got up there, I said, I'm not going to read this statement because it's too sterile. It's just too neat for this man. I have to speak the truth about the situation of all of us women. We were refugees, we're internally displaced, we're victims of rape, we're living off of the streets. People and their children were dying on a daily basis. Our daughters and sons were being conscripted as small boys into his army, into the armies of the rebels. So I had to tell him this is the reality of the Liberian people. This is the reality specifically of women of this country. And there was no fear in that telling. All that was there was a huge sense of anger that this one man has put us in all of this mess. That was what I was thinking on that day.
Well, eventually, you brokered a peace deal. Amazingly, a peace deal between Charles Taylor and the rebel warlords. You forced Taylor out of power, and he was later arrested for war crimes. Your movement led to the election of the first woman president in Africa. Truly a remarkable story. And it's remarkable partly because it's so rare. Almost always it's the generals, not the peace activists, who win. And I guess it raises the question of whether peace really can defeat war in any systematic way.
Well, I think where we need to come in this world, especially now, is to understand that good can always overcome evil and peace can definitely defeat war. You know, war, if you go back to the Liberian story, it was just a matter of time that peace was going to take over, peace was going to win.
Why would that be just a matter of time? It would seem that it could just drag on forever.
Well, it would seem that it would drag on forever, but I tell you one thing, that even those with the guns, they always pick up the guns, not in the name of war. And you need to remember that. When people go to war, they're always saying we're fighting in the name of peace, which is ironical, because there's no way fire can put out fire. So if you're going to war because you want peace, if someone offers you the perfect alternative to what you're killing yourselves for, you're bound to reach out and grab it.
But there are an awful lot of leaders, of historians, of philosophers who say war is inevitable, that we've always had war from the beginning of history. It seems to be a part of human nature. Are you saying war is not inevitable?
I can tell you one thing for free. Because of the way the world has come to glorify violence, that's why people think that war is inevitable. I think if we persistently and consistently throw out peace as the only alternative, because gun is the easiest way and a cowardly way of solving problems.
You mentioned that it's usually the men in power who conduct these wars. I'm assuming you would say that women have a particular role, a special role to play in preventing war.
Oh, definitely. The way I talk about it when I go to places of conflict is that in communities where you have a lot of the recruitment taking place, the women are the ones who know every young person. And so the metaphor I would want to use is her house. If it is dark, she can walk in and touch anything. And if you decide to fix her house and leave her out of it, you're leaving a very vital component of that fixing out of it. The woman knows of all of the fighters who you can talk to on which way and bring them back to a point of understanding. You keep them out of the room. You keep the conscience of those men out of the room. You keep the history of their lives out of the room. You keep the interaction in the community out of the room. And I think it's important for people to understand that, that process of bringing the country back to stability needs the involvement, intervention of every member of the population. If you're leaving 50% of the population out of the process, it's like trying to see a whole picture with one eye cover.
You see what you're advocating here as being realistic. I mean, this is not just pie-in-the-sky idealism. You think this works?
I think so. I believe it in my guts. And the reason why I'm saying it is, please help me understand. A few years ago, we're getting rid of Saddam Hussein. Today, we have ISIS. A few years ago, we got rid of Gaddafi. What we see in Libya is a total mess. A few years ago, Syria started with just protest, and then one armed group got in, another armed group got in. What we see now is another mess. Yemen and all of the bombings that have been taking place by the different high power countries. If violence could end anything, our world would be a peaceful place. What we've seen in this short period from 9/11 till today is a world that is even more dangerous. You want to go to concerts, you think twice. More than ever before in the history of the world, everyone lives with a deep sense of fear. If violence could solve any problem, why don't we have global peace?
That is a very good question. Wow, you are so inspiring. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Lima Bowie talking with Steve Paulson. She won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2011 for her role in ending the brutal civil war in Liberia. She's the founder and president of the Bowie Peace Foundation Africa. I think Lima's words resonate more strongly than ever this week. I don't know about you, but it helps me to remember her message and that there are people like her in the world. That's it for our show today, but there is always more on our website at ttbook.org. You can sign up for our newsletter, and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Charles Monroe Kane, Mark Rickers, Shannon Henry Kleiber, and Angelo Bautista. Our sound designer and technical director is Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson, and I'm Ann Strange-Champs. Thanks for listening.